Excited to welcome UNC Greensboro head coach Mike Jones to the basketball podcast. At UNC Greensboro, Coach Jones has continued his winning tradition with three consecutive 20-win seasons. Prior to joining UNCG in 2021, Jones spent a decade as the head coach at Radford University, leading the Highlanders to 174 wins, two Big South regular season championships in 2019 and 2020, and a Big South tournament title in 2018. That same season, he guided Radford to its third ever NCAA tournament appearance and was named both Big South Coach of the Year and NABC District 3 Coach of the Year. He earned a second Big South Coach of the Year honor in 2020 and was a finalist for the Skip Poser Man of the Year Award in 2019. Under Jones, Radford made postseason appearances in the College Basketball Invitational Tournament in 2014-2015 and recorded five seasons with at least 20 wins. Early in his career, Jones was an assistant coach at Georgia under Dennis Felton, where he contributed to the Bulldogs' 2008 SEC Championship and NCAA Tournament berth. His coaching journey also includes assistant roles at West Virginia, Richmond, Furman, and Howard, as well as a head coaching stint at Sidwell Friends School. With an overall record of 252 and 199, Jones has built a reputation for competitive success, player development, and leadership rooted in integrity.
Do you know which lineups and player combinations are the most productive? Hoopsalytics has the most comprehensive lineup analysis system available. Coaches can see how each group performs offensively or defensively or excels in special situations. For example, if you need to force a late game turnover, you can see which group has the best defensive turnover percentage, or see which four athletes work best with your star player. And you can do the same team-based analysis for groups of two or three players as well. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Discover how Hoopsalytics can help you make better data-driven coaching decisions. Visit hoopsalytics.com today to learn more.
Coach Jones, welcome to the Basketball Podcast.
Thanks, man. Appreciate you having me here, Chris.
Excited to talk to you. You come very highly recommended, and certainly I've known about your program for a while and your time at Radford as well. You're known as a defensive strategist, a defensive coach a little bit. Do you welcome that?
Yeah, absolutely, man. I learned how to play defense when I was in high school, fell in love with that. They told me back in the day, if you play defense, the coach will play you. So I believed them. And I was fortunate when I got to college, nobody wanted to play D, so I got to play it all I wanted. Once I got on the court, I got to do all the other stuff I wanted to do. So
that's great. You found an advantage in playing defense that helped your career. And do you feel like that's something you're doing for certain players as well?
Yeah, there's so much emphasis put on offensive side. And certainly you can't win games without outscoring the other team. But the defense is sometimes de-emphasized. And so just getting guys to understand the value that we're playing a sport where, you know, you got to play both. It's not football where you can play one side of the ball or the other. Baseball, similar. You're a really good hitter. They might DH you. But in basketball, man, there's no hiding. They're going to find that weak link. So we just try to make sure there's as few weak links as possible on the floor.
Of course, it seems like offensive metrics and just generally the eye test helps us identify offensive players a little bit easier. Is that something that you feel is true, or is defensive metrics and the ability to be able to identify a good defender caught up to offense?
Yeah, I'm not a big analytics guy. I don't understand it to that extent. I do think, for me, I trust my eyes and what I see. And they don't have to be great defenders coming in the door. They have to be willing defenders. And then we look for some instincts that they might have, or length, for instance, is a really good indicator of how good they can be. If they're athletic and they got long arms, then that's the way basketball players are built. And we look for guys like that on the defensive end. But really, we try to just teach them those basic fundamental stuff. It's not that difficult to learn, no matter what kind of athleticism or skill they have. They can learn it.
Of course, we talk about offensive development a lot. So I'm curious from your perspective, players coming into your program, coming particularly out of high school, let's say that they haven't played college first. And I know that's a rarity more and more nowadays, but let's say they do. Are they coming in a little bit better prepared to play defense than they used to? Or do you notice any differences at all?
No, I think it depends on the coach. Some guys that have really good high school coaches, they come in and they know how to play off the ball. They know what help side means. They know how to move their feet and stay between their man and the baskets. It really depends a lot. We've had both sides. We've had guys that come in that didn't maybe their high school coach played a lot of zone, and so they don't have very good man-to-man principles, or guys that have come in and they've had a really good high school coach who demanded of them playing man-to-man defense, and they come in with a little head start on the rest of the crew.
That checks. And this is a great time of year to ask you this question. You're starting up again with team practices, and you have already. So where are you starting with building the defensive foundation for your players?
Yeah, just the ultimate basic part of defense. Closeouts, stance, actually. We start with stance. We start with guarding the ball when it's not live. So hand positioning, feet positioning, where we want to influence the ball. We hate guys going middle on us, so we teach them how to depend on the side of the floor, you know, how to have your right foot or your left foot up, your right hand or your left hand up, and then being able to push off and slide or step and slide, depending on what they like best. This really the stuff that you learn when you go to your first basketball camp. And then from there, we progress to closeouts and being able to get to the ball in a hurry and contest shots and stop drives, all that stuff. So we start really from the basics of stance, and then we move forward with individual defense. And then when you're working with another teammate or with a team.
So a defensive buildup in that sense. And when are you helping them understand the whole? Is that at the beginning first before you start, or is that a gradual process?
We start by telling them what our philosophy is defensively, what we're trying to accomplish, what we don't want to happen with the other team's offense. And so once they hear that, then we remind them of that throughout the process. But then that helps them explain why are we doing this. It makes a little bit more sense when you explain what you're trying to do philosophically and then try to work with the fundamentals from there and then build back up to a team. And for us, man, we really have a defined philosophy defensively, and we want our team to know that. And we want them to know that we've been very successful with it, from Radford to here, from a team that has a lot of veterans to a team that has freshmen. Everybody is capable of doing this and establishing a really good defensive team.
I love that. That's great to connect for them, obviously, to see that no matter what level they're at, they can succeed in this defense. And for you, you mentioned this, what don't you want to have happen? So can you share that with us? What don't you want to have happen?
Yeah. Who wants to give up a layup? Who wants to give up a dunk? In transition, we talk about transition defense. We want to make sure that if there's one guy back, his job is to not give up a layup. Same thing in half court. We don't want guys to get a smack the backboard layup. So we do chart. That's one of the things from a analytics standpoint that we chart and that I pay attention to is how many baskets at the rim are we giving up? And so in the last few years, we've been really good at not letting that happen. And then we want to contest shots. We don't want to give guys open shots. We look at teams that shoot open shots, shoot it at about 75 or 80% clip. When you put a hand up and just contest a shot, they shoot it at a 33 to 35% clip. So it's very basic. Don't let a guy have an open shot. So no layups, no open shots. The things that we'll give up mid-range contested jump shots. We'll contest threes. We'll make you score through us at the rim. And even if you're 2 feet away, a lot of guys will miss that shot as long as there's a body in between them and they feel that body. It's just basic stuff. It's nothing that I'm saying this is a secret. I'm not telling anybody. I don't care if they know. These are the things that we have to do in order to give ourselves a chance to win night in and night out.
Basic stuff that you do incredibly well. And while that seems simple, we know that it's not that simple, is it?
No, it's something that we've become good at over the years, but we certainly have our droughts, so to speak, even in the midst of seasons where for one reason or another, you know, and different things factor into giving up layups. One year we were really bad transition defense-wise, and so half-court defense, we were really good. We didn't give up layups in the half-court, but we were giving them up in the full court. So it's an ongoing thing, and there are a lot of different factors that contribute to it. We just got to make sure we're analyzing what is contributing to those things.
In defensive transition, which I know you referenced, that's where it all starts. Where are you steering the ball? Where's the preference to be able to force the ball in transition?
What we want to do is we just want to get the ball on one side and keep it there. Don't let it change sides of the floor. Don't let them drive to the middle. So if they drive anywhere, they're driving to the baseline. It's where a lot of our help stuff is built. So we want to be able to limit the area that the offense can operate. And that's easier said than done, for sure. But that's the goal.
Basically, if we're thinking about this, you're just extending your half court to the full court or vice versa in terms of it's Correct. The same principles, the same rules.
Correct. Yeah. We say, hey, shell starts in transition. We work on shell every single day. Sometimes we work on transition shell. Sometimes we work on half court shell, but it's all shell. And the goal is to make their offense operate against five of our guys. We don't want it to be one-on-one. We don't want it to be three-on-two. We want it to be one-on-five, two-on-five, three-on-five, four-on-five, or five-on-five.
Keep those number advantages in your favor on defense.
In our favor all the time.
That's great. So thinking about then in the half court a little bit, and you mentioned shell type of stuff, what type of shell drills are you cycling through? A number of different ones, another number of different actions every day? Do you have a set thing? What is your philosophy with these different types of shell drills you're doing?
Yeah, so we have a basic package that we do every single day, whether it's game day or we're just starting off in the preseason. And the only variation is how long we go. We'll start off at the beginning of the year, we'll be 30 minutes of shell. And then later on, when we play a game, it might only be 6 minutes that day of shell, but it's shell. And we progress through closeouts. We start with closeouts every day. Sometimes they're dummy closeouts where the deep offenses are moving. Sometimes we have a live offensive player who's attacking you as you close out. So you got to figure out, am I the guy today that's getting attacked? Or in this particular spot, is this guy coming live? And so they never know. And so it keeps them on their toes. And then from there, we do our gap defensive principles. We play a lot of gap. We'll vary up and do some overplay from time to time, but not very often. It's mostly gap to keep people out of the lane. And then so we go through that gap principles. And then from there, we'll work on our rotations. Baseline rotation, if that happens, here's how we're going to guard it. Slot drive rotation, here's how we're going to guard it. And that could be 3-on-3, it could be 4-on-4. And then we'll do what we call 4-on-3 scramble or 5-on-4 scramble, where you're outnumbered and you got to figure out a way to stop them from getting a shot and get the rebound. And so we do quite a bit of that. Those are the basics every day. Closeouts, gap principles, baseline or slot rotation, and scramble situations. We do those every single day.
I love it. And so if I was to attend one of your practices, what would be one or two of the phrases that I would hear the most from your mouth as you go through practice? Like for me on offense, I'm always saying, figure it out, figure it out.
Yeah, figure it out. We do say that on defense. Yeah. What we say a lot is win the closeout, win it. How do you win a closeout? What does that mean? That means you're not going to give up an open shot. You're going to at least get there in time to contest it and make them see your hand. You're not going to let them beat you off the dribble. Rule number one for us, rule number one is basically when your man has the ball, stay between the ball and the basket. You'll hear that a lot. You'll hear ass to the glass, where we don't want to be so much on a side that a guy has a straight line drive. We want to make sure we're making him have to work to get around us. And so those are some of our favorites. And we try to drill that in their skulls so that it becomes second nature.
And you mentioned forcing baseline. Are you playing a traditional eye on the weak side, or are you playing in and out on the weak side in terms of those two defenders, or do you modify it based on who they're covering on the weak side?
Yeah, so definitely we want to stay a little closer to shooters sometimes, but for the most part, we want to load our whole defense to the ball. And teams want to skip the ball. Great, skip it. We work on being able to close out and be there on the catch on a skip pass. We also work on not letting them make rocket skip passes where it's on a line. We want to pressure the ball and make them have to throw it a little higher. That gives our defense a chance to recover a little bit better. But we absolutely want to load to that ball. And sometimes when the guys are really good shooters, depending on where they are on the floor, then we want to stick a little bit closer to them. But for the most part, we are pretty standard in that.
Are you Xing out the weak side, or are you trying to stay with matchups?
Yeah, we'll X out. Yeah, and since I've been here, one of my teams was just unbelievably good at Xing out. We would stay at the basket for help on the bottom, and then that top guy would just figure out where's that ball going. I'll get there first, and then that gives the other guy a chance to get to the next one. We like to do it. We're better at it some years than others.
Of course, aren't we always? Speaking of the baseline drive still, let's say there's a ball side post. How are we covering the post? And then what are the responsibilities in terms of a baseline drive for that post?
Yeah, so we're going to cover the post a variety of ways, especially this year, because we were a small team this year. Traditionally, when I first started coaching, I was coming out of the SEC, and every post player could give you 20 on the block. And so we would just front most of the time and make it hard on the ball to get in into the post. And then when we got into the Big South, not every team had a great post score, so we would play three quarter. This year, we'll do a little bit of everything. We'll front some, we'll three quarter, we will trap the post, we'll do all of that. And depending on how we're playing, the post is involved in the baseline rotation. So if you're playing three quarter on the high side and you see that drive, you want to break off and go help. If you're on the low side, it's a lot easier. You're right there to stop that baseline drive. But we also tell our weak side, hey, if the post is getting sealed high, then you got to be there. We've got like a built-in backup system
backup
in case
plan,
that
man.
drive happens. Yeah, in case that big can't get there. But
That's great.
We would love the big to come over and help when he can.
Of course. And you referenced your time at Georgia a little bit. That's the late 2000s, coach. Offense has changed a lot in that time. I'm curious, from your perspective, has defense changed a lot, or have you had to adapt a lot to be able to change to the offense?
Yeah, that's a good question. Stuff is always changing. It's like everybody, and there's a bunch of smart guys like you out there figuring out how to beat these defenses all the time. And we have to make those adjustments defensively. We've changed a lot. Our system has changed a lot since those days. There are things that we absolutely did then that we don't do now. We overplay a lot less. There's a lot less, I guess, danger in throwing the ball around the perimeter than we thought back in the day. Because one thing that really stood out in the SEC is if you allow teams to reverse the ball quickly, then that big that was low, he would duck you in and he'd either get a layup on a pass from the wing when it got to the second side, or that guard would rip drive and get all the way to the rim. And so we were like, we got to overplay. We can't let this ball get reversed that quickly. And nowadays, most teams allow the ball to be passed around the perimeter because we're in gap defense, but we've combated that a little bit by our post defense, how we play that, and also by our ball pressure.
Take us through a little bit of the ball screen defensive philosophy, since ultimately we play against a ton of ball screen no matter what we do on defense.
Yeah, a few years ago we went to icing the ball screen a lot. The NBA does that so much that I was reluctant to do it for the longest time, but one of my assistants was like, man, we need to switch it up. And it really, in the ball screen, helps a couple of ways. The main way it helps is it attempts to keep the ball out of the middle. And I think guards are 10 times more dangerous when they get the ball in the middle than they are when they're going baseline. So we try to keep the ball out of the middle. And so it also helps with the bigs, and they don't have to run all the way out, get fouls because they're out there trying to hedge and they're kneeing the guard in the leg or something like that. So we keep the bigs in confined spaces, and then we try to get our guards to be aggressive and physical to get over that screen, keep the ball on the side, and get back in front of the ball. But we switch a lot depending on our lineups, and I think this year that's going to be big for us to be able to switch. We've got a lot of guys similar size, but we've got some strong guys that can be physical and try to play a little bit of bully ball on the ball screens. And then we'll occasionally trap the ball screen. So those are our three main ways. And this year, I think we'll probably have a couple more.
I was going to ask you about switching anyways, and you referenced on the ball handoffs, I assume the same. Are you switching off the ball at all?
Sometimes, yeah. Infrequently. Yeah. We try to stay with people coming off the screens, but we'll switch if they're exchanging on the weak side to keep our help side intact. But I don't love it. Guys get lazy and it becomes a crutch to switch. And so we teach it from the hardest standpoint, which is staying with your man. And then we go to switch. And then if they ever get lazy, then I threaten them to go back to staying with their man. But yeah, it's certainly helpful sometimes to switch off the ball so that you can maintain your help side defense.
So there's a tactical advantage sometimes, but sometimes it gives up the mental advantage of defensive toughness and everything that goes with it. And I've heard other coaches talk about that, which I love. So I'm just curious from your perspective, maybe like defensive toughness, it's abstract, right? But how do you play help your players understand how to be tougher defensively, and then maybe like ways to be able to quantify that if you do?
Yeah, I heard Jeff Van Gundy on a podcast the other day. He said, we hit anything coming toward the ball. And that's, we haven't necessarily taught it like that, but we do want to be physical, especially on the strong side. And that involves guys cutting to the basket. We want to make sure that they feel us. Anybody cutting to the ball, whether they're flashing into the high post or flashing low, we want them to feel us when they're coming off of screens. We want to be physical on the screen, especially if you're guarding a cutter. There's a ton of ways to be physical, but and on the ball screen, we want to be physical. We want to be able to send get over that screen as much as we can. A lot of times, guys set illegal screens, so if you're soft on that screen, you're going to get crushed. And so we want to be the aggressor. We want to be the initiator of the physicality in those ball screen situations. Even when guys are going up to set a ball screen, we want to be physical and try to maybe push them off their line a little bit. Yeah, there's a ton of different ways to do it. And we always want to, I tell our team, I don't know if you remember when back in camp or something, someone would do the dollar bill trick where they'd hold the dollar bill in between the two fingers and they'd let it drop and you have to close your fingers. And so the whole point of that is, if you're the two fingers, you're reacting to the offense. You're the defense. And so the defense always has to react. And so we want to change that narrative. We want to say, we want to tell the offense what they can do, as opposed to us waiting to see what the offense does. We try to be the initiator and or the tone setter when it comes to where you can go or how, what positions you can be in. We want to say, no, you only can be in this position. And that makes our job easier. Otherwise, you're going to be chasing around people all the time, and that becomes very difficult.
I love that analogy. That's a good one. I think I remember that from 30 years ago working a basketball
That's
camp
right.
coach. So we're probably dating ourselves a little bit,
I
but
still do it. I still do
you
it, man.
still
Those
do it? I
guys have
love
no
that.
idea. Yeah,
That's
nobody takes the money.
nobody. That's awesome, coach. Curious then, I guess, from this perspective, you're pretty clear on your defensive concepts, your defensive principles, your defensive non-negotiables. So how do you balance it a little bit with some scheme flexibility versus different types of opponents? Do you modify it a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. We play in a league where, shoot, if you got nine other teams, 10 teams total in the league, so nine other teams, opponents, you'll have definitely six or seven different styles, like completely different styles. And a lot of it involves shooters on the floor. Most teams in our league have four or five shooters on the floor. And so that'll dictate whether or not we can double team as much as we'd like to, because if you double team a team full of shooters, you're going to give up an open three. And that's one way where we might adjust some of the things that we do a little bit more. We might full rotate on a ball screen. So I might come out and I think I want to ice, but now they have a shooter and I don't really want to switch because they'll dominate us in the switch. Then we might say, we're going to stay with it, make them throw the ball out, and then we'll rotate from the backside, and everybody's got to get to the next guy. So that's one way that we'll make an adjustment against a team like that. So, yeah, there are a lot of different styles. And so we have absolutely have to be flexible in how we guard these guys, or else they'll pick you apart. And even within the game, they'll start picking you apart in the game, and you got to switch up your style and how you do it, which that becomes fun. Now we make an adjustment. Let's see if they can make an adjustment, and that becomes that cat and mouse game that you love.
One of the reasons we probably both fell in love with coaching is that tactical battle back and forth, isn't it? Quite fun.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm curious then, with that, what would dictate a change for you? And like initially, a lot of coaches just talk about the first thing we're going to do is say, let's do it better. And then if it's still
Right.
hurting us, then we say, okay, we might have to make an adjustment. Do you go through any type of thought process like that?
Yeah, a lot of times, how effective those guards are with using the ball screen, for instance, no matter what you do, we want to go over the top. We want to go over the top, even if it's a guy that doesn't shoot it great. But now, if he's continually putting pressure on our big guys trying to stay in front, then we might slide under sometimes and make a few pull-up jump shots off the dribble, pull up threes. But no, I don't, yeah, other than just personnel and how they're attacking it and how effective they are with it, we don't necessarily want to jump to changing it right away. We do want to be better. at what we're doing. And usually there is a reason that they're getting an advantage, and it's something that we try to analyze quickly and make the adjustment. And then if not, then we have some other things that we say for this next 4 minute stretch, we're going to trap the ball screen and we're going to put some doubt in his mind. And so every time now we step up, he thinks maybe there's a trap. And so we try to do a little bit of that from time to time as well.
Hey, coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know, the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to Basketball Immersion's group memberships. It's affordable and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams, get started now. Basketball Immersion Group membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast.
You referenced it at the beginning with your own game that somebody told you if you play defense, you can create an advantage for yourself. I'm curious, within your program, obviously it's a cultural identity to play defense. What are some ways that you celebrate it? What are some ways that you bring more life to playing defense as our identity within your program?
Yeah, that's a great question. We have this sign in our gym and we call it EGBs, which are energy generating behaviors. We have a sports psychologist that works with our team. He works with a lot of teams around the country. So you'll hear it on some of the TV broadcasts that teams use EGBs. So it's not unique to our program, but we love it because what it does is, so there are 16 or 17 different EGBs, energy generating behaviors. Number one, it takes your mind off of scoring because none of these things really involve scoring. And if there's 16 of them, then at least 13 of them, 12 or 13 are defensive oriented. There's a few that don't have anything to do with either, like huddles and dapping each other up. But the majority of them, I would say not 12, maybe 9 or 10, are defensive. And we have an EGB warrior at the end of every game where whoever just affected the game and from an energy generating behavior standpoint is the EGB warrior. We give them their little belt and we celebrate them in social media and the locker room and all that sort of stuff. But just making them understand that this is a point of emphasis. We value this. It's pretty simple in coaching, man. Whatever you emphasize and value, they're going to emphasize and value. And they know that this is important to us. We go crazy when guys make really good defensive plays. We can't take charges anymore, thanks to all the rule changes in college basketball, which I absolutely hate with every ounce of fiber in my body. But we used to really go crazy when a guy would take charges. One of our coaches, Randy Phillips, we call him Pop, when we were at Radford, he took 27 by himself in a year. So that's almost a charge a game. And we just try to celebrate those things and bring it out. And we do it every day. They know we're not going to skip a day when we don't do shell. They understand the value of it, and we try to celebrate them when they do it.
I love that. And maybe take us through that for those that aren't as familiar with the college game. I totally get what you're saying. The charge has changed a lot. And in your opinion, not for the betterment of the game, but maybe take us through, what is the change and how have you adapted? Are we able to go to more verticality now, like the NBA? Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's the idea. The idea for us has always been, let's say there's a baseline drive and your teammate is expecting help to be there. We want to be there early, and we want to be there early so that we can show that offensive player there's nowhere to go. And maybe he'll stop, maybe he'll pick up his dribble, and then that allows his defender to get back in front of him. But now with the charge, again, you have to be there so early in order to take a charge before a guy even goes into his pickup that it's almost impossible to do that. By the time you get there, no matter how early you are, that offensive player has probably already gathered the ball to go into his move. And so you're going to get called for a block if there's any contact. And so now what we do is we still emphasize getting there early, but then we're ready to, when they leave their feet, for us to leave our feet. That verticality rule, we work on it now. We never used to work on that, or very rarely, and now we work on it pretty consistently, so guys get used to it. And the guys, they know that if you get there what you think is early is now late. They're going to call a block on you. And but we still try to emphasize just being there with our body early to show that guy that, hey, you're going to have to navigate around this defender.
So years ago, the only place I'd ever see that being worked on is the NBA, obviously. And then Correct. Over the last few years, for sure, at many college programs, I've seen it. Can you give us some more of the depth of the teaching points when you're rotating in help now, instead of taking the charge, applying the rules of verticality?
Yeah, basically, when let's say it's a slot drive, so somebody's driving down the lane line and a big is on the block, on the opposite block, and our big comes over to help. When he comes over, he's got to know if he gets there good and early and he's outside of that restricted line, he has a choice. He might be able to stand in or he might be able to go vertical. But when he's inside that restricted arc, he's got to go vertical every time. And we spend 80% of the time working on the verticality and maybe 20% saying, okay, you're early enough to take that charge. And so it's just a matter of sprinting over, getting your feet outside of that restricted, knowing where you're on the floor, and then being able to make a decision on the speed of the offensive player versus how quickly you can get to the spot. But yeah, verticality is just go straight up and try to keep your hands even with you, because a lot of times you hear guys go, my hands were like this, but they're actually like this. And anytime they're leaning forward a little bit, you're going to get called for a foul on contact. So we try to teach them to throw their hands back as much as it can. Then if there's slippage, they come forward a little bit and you're okay. But yeah, it's not as difficult as one might think, but you do have to put it in their minds of where they are on the floor and the fact that most of the time they're going to have to go vertical rather than try to stand in for a charge.
Of course, no player's ever fouled with their hands in front of their body.
Never.
It's always the go-to. Coach, what are the things that have changed? I know we're giving the advantage to the offense. We're trying to increase scoring to a certain extent, but are there some other things that stand out to you that might have been modifications that have affected the way you have to teach defense?
Yeah, we want the offense to be uncomfortable. And so defensively, when you're pressuring guys on the ball and you make them travel, you need that call defensively. And nowadays, they don't call traveling very much. They allow extra steps. Something that was allowed, that is allowed now, that wasn't allowed probably 4 years ago. I know my first year here, it wasn't allowed. Now it's allowed, which is an extra step after you've come to a stop. So you maybe come to a 1-2 pivot. And before, you had to now keep that pivot foot down. If you jump, you had to jump off 2 feet. Now you can actually take that extra step, which was a rule in girls basketball or women's basketball, but now it's in our game. And so now that means you got to get there. And even though that guy has stopped his dribble, you got to be able to move your feet and stay between him and the basket when he's pivoting, and they get that extra pivot. And guys are getting around defenders all the time because of that move. And it wasn't allowed 4 years ago. So that part has really made us have to change how we guard and things that we teach and emphasize.
Well, wait till everyone is doing the Euro pause this year as well. Euro step to a pause. Like where literally they freeze on the last step of a Euro. You're seeing it a lot more. I saw some player. Yeah, like at the end, like you literally pause
right.
And then you can pass it or shoot it. And if you really think about it, you think about something.
That's
technically,
crazy.
It's not a travel, but it's a discontinuation of movement, right?
Yeah.
Some of these things, offense is always evolving, so it's fun because more people, I guess, are working on it. But
I'll have to ask. We got a bunch of Euro guys on our team, so I'm going to have to ask them if they know about this and do about it.
You're seeing it in the pros, so you're going to see it down lower as you see. But Coach, it brings up a point a little bit about individual differences. Certainly, we talk about offense. Sometimes there's individual differences. Not every player shoots it exactly the same way. Is there the same thing on defense? Are there some individual defensive differences with, say, closeout, stance, movements, different things like that?
Yeah, one area is certain guys, they just naturally are physical. So they are physical to get over ball screens, or they're physical to get through screens and things like that. And some guys, they want to lay on those screens like pillows. And we got to make sure that everybody is understanding how to get around those screens. So there's that teaching point there of how to navigate a screen without actually getting hit by it, back in the day, they always used to teach us to get low because a big screener comes and he's got his big shoulders and he's going to hit you with that upper body. So now if you get low, you can wedge yourself around it. But I haven't seen it taught a lot like that over the years, but that's something that we still teach, to trying to get low and get skinny and be able to get past screens without getting hit, and certainly laying on it and giving an advantage to the offense against our post players. Those are some things that we talk about a lot. And some guys are, like I said, more naturally inclined to be physical and hit you, and some guys aren't. But yeah, defenders aren't as there isn't as much variation between defensive players as there are offensive players. But part of the defenders' issues involve willingness. And that's where we have to get everybody at least on the same page that, hey, I tell every guy, I don't care what position you play. I don't care how much you play. Every guy on our team has the role of defending and rebounding. Every guy. So when we talk about roles at the beginning of the year, everybody has those too. And then because of their offensive differences, we give them their roles for our team. But every guy, I don't care if you're 5 foot five or 7 foot, you have to defend and rebound for our team.
Like, I really like that phrasing. No matter what, your role is to defend and rebound, is what you're saying. And then from there, we can figure it out based on your individual talents and everything that goes with it.
Correct.
Really clarifying things for players, no doubt, in your program. Offensively, the game's going a little conceptual in terms of not running these plays necessarily as rigid systems and more conceptual, more actions blended together. Is there an equal kind of concept like that on defense, where now players are getting a little bit more freedom to make decisions within your defense?
Not within ours, no.
And I didn't think so, but I was just curious. Yeah.
No, basically, no matter what kind of offense you run, somebody's going to have the ball and four other people are not going to have the ball. And so when you're on the ball, there are certain things that we expect you to do on that ball. We expect you to attract the attention of the ball handler. We want him to think about you rather than think about where his open man is, where his open teammate is. And those things don't change. How you close out doesn't change. Somebody's getting the ball and you're at a varying distance from them. You're close to him, you're far away, but we want to influence when he catches it and you get to him, which way he goes. We want to influence, does he get an, you know, open shot? So your closeout has to be consistent. How you sprint to get there, you have a high hand, you're active, you're chopping your feet, and you're ready for him to try to attack you. So for us, the offense changes, but defensively, the consistency can still be there.
I love that. I love that phrasing, and I hope coaches caught that. When you're covering the ball, you want them to be focused on you and not their ability to be able to see other things. And that's a really good way of phrasing that for sure. Connecting it, you already referenced this year being a smaller team, and generally sometimes you compete against bigger teams no matter what at your level, and you've done that throughout the years at Radford. So talk to us a little bit about defensive rebounding. Particularly, I think last year you had a positive rebounding margin and we're at one of the tops of your league in rebounding. But what are some of the specific rebounding habits or positional techniques that you emphasize for your team?
Yeah, I heard someone use the phrase about the extending the radius around the rim where the ball can come off, and extending that so you have more room for error, so to speak. When that rebound comes off, you're still on the inside and you can get it. So it really starts with just being able to drive guys back who are being aggressive to come rebound. And the number one thing I'll say is this: you have to have five guys that are committed to getting that rebound. No matter how many guys are coming to the offensive glass, no matter how big they are, if you can just outnumber them every single time with five and they have four, or they have three, or they have two, then you're probably going to have a chance to get that ball. And then you add to that the attention to the guys who are being aggressive to rebound and take them out through boxing out or double teaming them if it's a really big and good rebound, or putting a second guy on him. But they're really just five guys in there, and they're all committed to pursuing the ball and getting that rebound before anything else happens. So a lot of times you have guys that want to leak out. They want to contest a shot and keep going, see if they can get a layup down the other end. And now you got four. And then as soon as there's four, now there's an extra guy coming to rebound without somebody paying attention to him, the offense gets to rebound. It's having that mentality of every single time there's five And every single time, those five guys are just pursuing that basketball. Nobody's saying, oh, he's going to get the rebound. I'm going to let him have it. I'm saying we start to go toward that ball until we see our teammate has got it. So those two things, I think, are the critical pieces to it. And then from there, blocking out those aggressive rebounders, that's probably the next step, and figuring out how to keep them off the glass.
So do we figure out to keep him off the glass, an elite tall rebounder or physical rebounder on another team? What are we doing scouting report wise?
Yeah, the number one thing is we try to keep our matchups consistent. So rather than switching, rather than having the advantage where I got to come over and help and then I got to go back and block out, we emphasize staying in front of the ball. So now no help is needed. It's a lot easier to rebound when you're next to your guy than if you're coming from a position of help or up the line or something like that. And so it starts with that. Like, you can help our defensive rebounding by just making sure that you're guarding your yard. And then from there, so we have a guy named, I referenced him earlier, Randy Phillips. He was an elite offensive rebounder. And so he'll be in practice in rebounding drills, and he's about 300 pounds. And so our guys have to wrestle. We say wrestle the gorilla. There's a gorilla in there, and you can't just block him out with one arm or hit him, get turned around and go rebound. He's going to push through your back. And so now you got to do everything you can to make sure he doesn't get that rebound, even if it means face guard on the block out with him. But we would love to be able to deliver a blow to that offensive player, stop his momentum, and then turn around and drive our legs and our butt back into him and back him away from the basket. We would love to be able to do that. In an ideal world, you would do that the first 4 minutes of a game, and those guys wouldn't be interested in continuing to come in there because they know every time they come, they'll get hit. And so, again, it's a mentality, but we're not always good at it. And we've had some success at varying levels over the last 4 years. But sometimes we've been consistently good, but not as great as we need to be. And so that's an area that we've got to continue to get better.
Spoken like a true coach. We've done
Yeah.
okay, but we can do better.
Man, no question. No question.
All these years of coaching.
Carolina is always one of the leading teams in defensive rebound. And you look at it, they got two big goons out there every day. Over all those years, they always got a Armando Bacot and another 6'10, 250-pound guy. Makes rebounding a little bit easier. We don't have that luxury, so we got to be able to hit guys and drive them back and have some technique to it, but also do it as a gang with five guys.
You've done a great job with that, and the consistency in the program over the years, both your stops has shown that. Curious if you can connect for us a little bit. At least we think that you're just a defensive coach and you only play defense, obviously. You play offense too. So take us through a
Yeah.
little bit. How does your offense connect? What are some things that you do offensively that kind of help connect the defense and the offense together, maybe?
Yeah, the number one thing that we do is we recruit good players, especially at the guard position. No matter if you're playing NBA basketball or peewee ball, eight and under, the guards dominate the game because they have the ball in their hands. They're making decisions all the time. And we made an adjustment really after my first year at Radford, where we very rarely will play without two point guards on the floor at any given time. And so all the pressure is not on one guy to do the ball handling and the decision making. Back in the day when I was in school, there was a primary ball handler, and he didn't necessarily have to shoot. He would just run the team, and good teams would take him out, and now the cut the head of the snake off, and now all of a sudden the offense isn't as good as it used to be. So for us, we don't want to be in that situation. We want to have two, sometimes three playmakers on the floor. We've changed our position names. We don't have a one, a two, a three, a four, and a five. We have playmakers, we have wings, and we have forwards. And so if we can have two or three playmakers on the floor at any given time, then we're probably going to be get a good shot. We're probably going to be able to run our offense effectively. So it starts with that. And then we hope that our defense will create opportunities for us to get out and run and get some easy opportunities. I tell our team, if you get a stop, we're not running a play. If you get a stop, then we are going to push the ball in transition and try to get numbers, and then we'll get into our secondary offense. We'll flow into that pretty quickly. But if you get scored on now, we're going to walk it up or we're going to come up and run a set, which I know you don't want to do that as much. We give them an incentive to get stops so that we can turn that defense into offense.
Definitely an incentive. They don't want to do that for sure as much.
Yeah.
But they know it's necessary as well. Take us through just quickly one of your practices then in terms of balancing these things, balancing offense, balancing defense. You referenced some of the things that you do defensively every day. Talk to us about a little bit of balancing to make sure that your offense is obviously capable of winning a championship as well.
Yeah, so we do a good amount of dummy offense, whether it's 1-on-0, 2-on-0, all the way up to 5-on-5. We also do something that we did at VCU with Shaka. We do parts of the offense. And so we might have three guys involved in an action that we do, and we'll do that action, and all three guys will get shots out of it. So it's option one is hit the big on the ball screen and roll in the pocket, and he goes and scores. Option two is hit the guard in the corner, lifting up, throw it back, and he's got a shot. And then option three is the guard might get a second ball, and now he's coming off and making an offensive play. And so different ways to take just a part of the offense that we want to emphasize and what guys should be doing. And here are the two or three options. And let's do this over and over again so you're getting multiple reps. So we'll do some parts of the offense. Like I say, usually it's 3-on-3. A lot of times it's 4-on-4 with managers and GAs doing the defensive part of things. And then we play a lot. I'm talking to some of the great coaches at the mid-major level over the years. They agree, man, nothing beats playing. And so you put them in different situations, whether it's start with a baseline out of bounds and then we'll play this possession and then we'll convert down to the other end, or plan possessions. You get six possessions on offense and then the other team gets six. So we'll go offense down and back. But we play a lot of situations, whether it's a 9-point game, 11-point game, special situations we work on a good amount where it's a minute and 20 on the clock and you're down 4, it's your ball baseline out of bounds or sideline out of bounds with 20 seconds on the shot clock. And we'll put our guys in those situations so they become habit forming. So when the game happens, we don't have a timeout. Guys got a feel for how things should go. So we do a lot of that offensively as well.
Coach, you've been around the game for a while and you've done an incredible job, obviously, as a head coach. And we can hear the passion in your voice for defense and coaching and all the beautiful things that come with the game. So I know you're looking forward to this year. Talk to us a little bit about this season and maybe some of the influences you've had in your life as well.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this year. This team has got me excited just because there's so many new guys on the team. They're from every different type of program you can think of. Very few of us recruit high school kids anymore, but we got 5 of them that are freshmen this year, and 3 of them are probably going to play a lot of minutes for us. And that's, we did that a good amount at Radford and had some success with it, but we haven't done it a lot since we've been here. So that'll be different, and I'm excited to see how quickly they pick things up. But just having so many players from diverse backgrounds on our team this year, whether it's overseas or different college programs or coming out of high school or junior college, I'm excited about teaching more so than ever. And our staff is excited because we see the potential in our players. But obviously, there's a long way to go in order for them to be effective individually or for our team to be any good. I think I can speak for our entire staff that we're excited about the group that we have and to see how far we can take them. And a lot of people won't think very much of us, which is, I always like being the underdog. I've been in both roles, but I really like being the underdog on things and hopefully get a chance to really surprise some people.
You've won 20 games multiple times there, so it's hard to imagine them thinking you're an underdog, but I get it.
We've also lost a lot of good players.
I get it. Rosters change over so much nowadays. Yeah. You never know. And that's exciting. No, before you go, I'm just curious, like recruiting high school kids, does that now become a little bit of a potential advantage since high school kids aren't getting recruited as much?
Yeah, I've looked at it like that ever since the portal happened. We didn't go out and try to recruit 5 every year, but we would try to get 2. And from that standpoint, if you get 2 from good programs that are coached, number one, they don't expect to play as much as an upperclassman. So that's a good thing. Can't play 12 guys anyway. And then number two, once they figure it out, you get them for maybe an extra year. And so we had some good ones over the last few years that stayed in the program for 3 or 4 years. And they become the basis of your program with guys coming and going. We've never wavered from recruiting high school guys. And we will continue to do that. And this year, we've got more than usual, but it's all a good thing.
You referenced Coach Felton and Shaka really quick. Maybe just talk about their influence as we wrap up.
Yeah, man. I got into coaching because of him. I wasn't one of those guys who grew up saying he was going to be a coach, but then when I saw him doing it, he was a teammate of mine in college. He really gave me the initial blueprint of what to do, how to carry myself, how to recruit. And then we both had a defensive philosophy, framework in coaching, and we were very similar in that way. And he had a lot of success at Western Kentucky and Georgia with the defense that he implemented, and a lot of that was similar to where I grew up. Indebted to him for those nuggets that I got from him. And then Shaka became a real influence from a offensive standpoint because he was in Billy's system at Florida, and I really, being at Georgia, admired the way Billy ran offense. And so some of the things that he would do, we still do to this day. And but he was also an influence in terms of how you build a team and what's important in building that team. And the main thing that he taught me was about how important relationships were, making those guys understand that you care about them and that you are rooting for them and you believe in them. And you have to do that by working at it. You have to spend quality time with them off the court, or you have to spend time working with them one-on-one or watching film with them one-on-one. But once you get that relationship with them, man, the basketball stuff takes care of itself. And so I learned a lot of that from Shaka.
I love it. And we're so grateful that you shared with us all these different experiences and your knowledge of defense and program building and all the success that you've had as well. So thank you so much for sharing the game with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, man. I'll have to go back through those. How many episodes? 300 and how many?
380 or so. Yeah, coach, we got to catch
Yeah,
up.
I got to go back through, man, and learn some stuff. But I really
Now,
appreciate
if you did
you
do that, would you filter by offense first or defense
having
first? That's
me on.
the
I got to filter by offense first. I got to learn.
Beautiful. Love that, coach. Thank you
Yeah.
so much.